This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, there are a chosen few that will stand against the vampires, the demons, and the forces of darkness. These are the voyages of the crew of Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
And you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9 with your presenters, Kaz and Albert. And tonight, with the Australia Day coming up on Tuesday next week, we're going to be talking a little bit about how Australia has contributed to the scene of science fiction, horror, and looking a little bit at urban legends as well.
And the track we heard just before was an instrumental version of Waltzing Matilda.
Very appropriate.
Very appropriate. And Waltzing Matilda is probably one of the older kind of ghost tales, I suppose you would say. It was composed, I think the lyrics were written by, was it Banjo Paterson in the late 19th century? And one of the last verses says, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me, and his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me."
Yes, and it's got all these complicated themes like suicide and robbery of sheep. So,
among other things.
Yes, yes. It's very detailed kind of the song, even though it's you know, known as the unofficial Australian national anthem. So
it really is. Yes. And I remember when I first heard that when I was at primary school, it scared me. I did not want to go down to a billabong.
Yeah, I didn't really know
what that was, but I didn't want to go down by the Coolabah tree either, just in case that man's ghost was still there.
Yes, I know. I mean, I probably heard it way back and never really listened to the meaning of the song and just went along with it blindly. So if you do kind of look into it, it's quite a disturbing tale.
It really is a disturbing kind of song, especially when you think of just everything, like you said, that's involved the crime, the suicide,
yes,
the stigma that's now attached to billabongs,
yes,
or for me forever anyway.
Yeah. Throughout the show, we're going to be looking at kind of Australian culture and a little bit more specifically, movies such as Wolf Creek and the short film Saw, and also what actually makes Australia kind of such a good example for a horror setting, or the isolation, the venomous animals, things like that. So the first thing we're going to look at tonight is the 2005 film Wolf Creek, which it's quite an iconic film. I mean, most people that hear of Wolf Creek actually, you know the story and know how gory it is. So hopefully when we go through it, we're not going to be spoiling too much for you. So when Wolf Creek opens, it starts with the kind of the standard text in their black background where they say the following is based on actual events. 30,000 people are reported missing in Australia every year. 50% are found within a month. Some are never seen again. So it kind of sets the whole premise of the movie as it is based on actual events. Even though it's never specifically based on a single event, the characters are kind of loosely based around the backpacker murders in 1990. The characters in the movie are quite simple, really. There's the Australian, played by Nathan Phillips, who joins two English tourists, played by Cassandra McGrath and Kirsty Morassi. They go on an adventure across Australia, and they driving across the Australian outback towards what's known as Wolf Creek, the giant crater in the middle of nowhere, so they can, you know, just as a sightseeing tour.
Yeah, that name totally inspires confidence.
Yes, yes, I know. It's and it kind of because the movie was based on actual events, there is a place called Wolf Creek, and there is actually a giant crater, but it is set. The movie's kind of filmed in South Australia, but the actual crater itself is in Western Australia. It's quite a short film. They don't drag it out too long. So once they get to the crater, they see everything. Grah's character, Liz Hunter, is Nathan Phillips' love interest in the film, so they get it on a little bit. And once they get that out of the way of the storyline, it gets dark, and when they try to leave, Wolf Creek, or try to leave the crater, they find that their watches have suddenly stopped and their car doesn't work. So they're basically stuck in the middle of nowhere without any way to get out of there, and they don't even really know what time it is. So they decide they need to spend the night there in the car and wait until sunrise before they can try to find help.
That's it. And you know from then it's all going to go horribly wrong.
Yes, yes. They're completely alone. They're all by themselves. And even though the movie seems quite real, there's kind of a supernatural mystery surrounding that, because there's...
That's right. Yeah, and they kind of, you sort of, you think about the magnetic forces and things like that.
Yeah, and they talk about UFOs.
That's right.
How that caused, blackouts.
The lost time. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So during the middle of the night, they suddenly see headlights heading towards them, or they think it's headlights. They're lights off in the distance, and they're, you know, all by themselves, so they're worried what it is. And they realise it's someone supposedly supposed to be trying to help them, which is Mick Taylor, who's played by the fabulous John Jarrett.
Very creepily by John
Jarrett. Yes, yes. So it's a far cry from his days in Better Homes and Gardens in the 1990s. Yeah, he plays such a great villain in this movie. The storyline's pretty simple. He's obviously pretty deranged and he's out to kill tourists. The whole movie, there's not a lot to the storyline, but it's still quite an enjoyable experience once you watch it. Some of the gory things that I remember from watching the movie, which I think is actually something that I remember from Hostel, where he's attacking Liz after she's tried to come back after...
Yes, that's right, because they kind of escape.
They escape. Liz is kind of the central character. That's where who you see first when she wakes up. She's tied up and she frees herself. She finds Mick, the serial killer, torturing Christy, her English friend. She manages to shoot Mick in the neck, who becomes unconscious, and they are able to escape. And this was the only criticism I have for the movie. They manage to subdue the villain.
Yes.
Run out of bullets, or they can't manage to reload the gun. He's lying on the ground, and she tries to bash him with the gun on the back, which doesn't really do much, and they still freak out and they try to run away. So they manage to escape. They get a car with keys and they drive away. But of course, being shot in the neck and him being a supervillain, he's not going to be dead just from that.
He doesn't go down easily.
No, no. So I always try to put myself in these people's situations. I try to really get into the movie, and I remember watching TV shows like 24, how there's always these terrorists and what you need to do to try to get away. And it always comes to mind, if you can't shoot them, at least you can do is bash their head in until you can see brains.
That's always probably a safe bet.
Yeah, it's kind of normally a surefire way to make sure they stop chasing you.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, we can't let reality get in the way of a good movie, though.
Absolutely not. But it does remind me, I don't know if you've seen the movie Vacancy.
Vacancy.
With Kate Beckinsale and Luke Wilson in it.
No, no.
That's the kind of movie where watching it on TV, you're yelling at the film for them to not go into that room or to not put that thing or to not open the door, and they don't. Okay. They kind of, it's almost like they invert it and they take all of those rules and turn them around.
Yeah.
So everything you would do if you were in the situation, having watched so many horror films, they kind of follow it. And, and it's one of those films that is better for it.
Oh, yeah. So
kind
you really
breaks the mold. Yeah.
At least feel for the characters
because they don't make those stupid mistakes, going back.
Yes, yes. They have a bit of common sense.
That's it.
Yeah. So there's certainly a lot of gory stuff, like Mick slashing Liz's fingers off, and you see the I think three fingers drop onto the floor, and him stabbing her in the back, so he paralyzes her.
He stabs her through the car. That's
yeah,
right.
She comes back after fleeing the mining site where the car was supposed to be fixed. She comes back because the car that they were driving, they pushed off the cliff, so they tried to
sort of throw them off the trail.
Throw Mick off the trail to think that he doesn't need to chase them anymore. But obviously, without a car, they still needed to get away, so she goes back to the mining site.
Classic mistakes.
Tries to grab another car and gets stabbed through this chair,
God.
So, a lot of gory stuff. And I think what makes the film really good is John Jarrett's character.
He absolutely takes the film out of the ordinary.
Yeah, yeah, he plays it so well, not just how he plays it, but the character itself. He's so skilled. He's certainly skilled with his rifle and his knives. but he's the hunter that you would never want to encounter. So
no, it's like those classic urban legends about people going, you know, sending you out into the forest and then giving you a head start and coming after you.
It's
that kind of freaky.
He'll play games with you. He's not out for the body count. He's only in this
it's
movie.
About
only,
the game.
It's about the game. It's about the chase. He wants to draw it out because he gets obviously more thrill from hunting you down than actually the final kill. Yeah, as I said, it was based around actual true events. John Jarrett's character is similar to the Australian backpacker murderer Ivor Milat back in the early 90s. And in the film, the mining site that Mick brings his victims to belongs to the Navitalum Mining Company. And for those of you playing at home, Navitalum is Ivan Milat's name, transposed and reversed. The film was released in Australia on 3rd November 2005, except in the Northern Territory, where it was actually released in January 2006, because they needed to wait until after the trial of Bradley John Murdoch had finished so the jury would not be influenced.
And that was a Peter Falconio.
Yes, yeah, he was the one that was still currently serving life imprisonment for the July 2001 murder of Peter Falconio and the assault
abduction
of his girlfriend.
Yeah, Joanne Lees.
So that gets you in the mood of how Australia sees horror and how it can kind of mess with your head a little bit.
It really can. And how that kind of larrikin idea, sort of, you know, blokey larrikin can turn.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's kind of based on, well, they make fun of him as Crocodile Dundee and, you know, this isn't a knife.
Yeah,
call that a knife.
If Crocodile Dundee hadn't used his knife on crocodiles, he'd used it on people instead.
Yes.
Probably would have turned out a lot like this character.
Yeah, so I'm sure it probably doesn't do a great deal of service for Australian tourism, but.
Oh, well, I remember when that came out and they were worried that it was going to sort of keep people away, I suppose.
Yeah.
But instead, it was the opposite. And more people started travelling to Australia.
Yeah.
I don't know what that says about us or about the people who travel here, but.
As long as I wasn't focusing on the deadly sharks or the venomous spiders and snakes.
Of which we have plenty in Australia.
So that's for anyone that's listening overseas, that's probably going to kill you sooner than John Jarrett will.
If you ever meet John Jarrett, apparently he's a lovely man. Don't be worried about it.
Yes. And we're going to go to a couple of messages and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Sci-Fi and Squeam. You're with Albert and Kaz tonight, and that track was Psycho Killer. Now, the original was done by Talking Heads, and that version was done by a band called Six and Out, which comprises Australian cricketers, including Brett Lee and his brother. And I have to admit, I bought that when I was, I think, in high school, when I had a bit of a crush on Brett Lee.
Brett Lee.
That's nothing to be proud of.
he was a clear Bachelor of the Year one year, I think
he was.
Oh, he
was too.
Yeah.
And look, they do a perfectly acceptable version of Psycho Killer. I'm sorry if it's offended any Talking Heads fans out there.
No, I mean, Psycho Killer probably could be covered by anyone, and it's still...
It's a great song.
It's a great song,
and I thought it was pretty appropriate talking about Wolf Creek.
Yes. Mick Taylor, the Psycho Killer.
So we're going to go on and talk a little bit more about how Australia contributes to the world of horror and sci-fi. I've done a quick scan of the internet and my own bookshelves as well, and it suggests to me that Australia produces far more fantasy writers than straight sci-fi or horror writers. I'm happy to be corrected, and I'd love suggestions from other readers. I'm always looking for something to pick up, so you can always SMS or email us or hit our Facebook page.
Yep.
Just search for Sci-Fi and Squeam. And it also seems that while I read books by sort of English-American writers or Russian writers or Japanese writers, they tend to produce work that is culturally recognisable. So they put a little bit of their own culture in there. It's a little bit harder for Australian authors. We've got a really small market in Australia, so they tend to write for international audiences and occasionally borrow inspiration from other nations. One of my favourites, and someone who has kind of taken my entire family captive with his last two series of books, is Ian Irvine. And I think Irvine bucks the trend that I spoke of earlier by setting some of his books in Australia. Irvine is a fantasy writer who has also written works described as eco-thrillers. He's a qualified marine biologist, and he calls his View from the Mirror Quartet a kind of Darwinian fantasy as different species fight for their right to exist and, in most cases, to dominate the others. One of Ian Irvine's most popular novels is The Last Albatross, and that's the first in his Human Rights trilogy. The Last Albatross is set in 2010 in an Australia where life is controlled by the net and the environment is in serious jeopardy. I think we can see a little bit of...
Oh, yes.
Modern day 2010.
Yes, yes.
In that. His works have been translated into Russian, Korean, Dutch, German and Greek, just to name a few languages. And he's currently working on his next series of books with the working title The Fate of the Children. And the setting or the setup for this series was hinted at towards the end of his last series of books, which is the Song of the Tears trilogy. Mm-hmm. He has this knack of kind of leaving you hanging at the end and then introducing yet another series of books.
Wanting more.
He really does. Yeah. And my bookshelf it's just groaning under the weight of all these books. It was kind of, I mean, I say he hinted at it, but it was a massive twist at the end and I was just surprised squawking all over the house. Another recognisably Australian author is someone called Kerry Arthur. Now, Kerry Arthur is fairly new to the scene. She's a Melbourne-born and based author who has a series of books called the Riley Jensen Guardian series, and it's actually set in the mean streets of the Victorian capital, Melbourne. It's just keep getting meaner, actually. Mm-hmm. However, this is not the Melbourne that we know. Vampires and werewolves stalk the nights, and standing between them and us is the Melbourne branch of the Directorate of Other Races.
Oh.
The protagonist, Riley Jensen, works for the organisation and she is herself a rare hybrid of vampire and werewolf. Of course she is.
Oh, yes.
Arthur's books are a really fun read. They're a mix of crime, supernatural and thriller genres. And since they're set in our hometown, I love reading the passages that describe kind of the characters walking down a street in Richmond or ducking into a city laneway. I'd love to meet one of those vampires. Oh, yes. I mean, I don't know.
It's always kind of nice to hear of places that you already know or the places you've visited and kind of imagine what the story in a book coming to life.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it makes you get into it a lot more.
I think it does. And I think her books in particular, I think she's sort of new to that particular genre with supernatural characters in it. Yeah. I think she's a romance writer originally or something like that. But does a really good job. And much like another writer, Kerry, I'm getting her name wrong, aren't I? It's not Kerry Armstrong.
the actress. No.
Kerry Greenwood.
Uh-huh.
Kerry Greenwood also sets a lot of her novels in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And it's just great. Like when they talk about Flinders Street and Flinders Lane and all these little places, you just kind of get really excited.
It's always good to go to a cafe and late at night and you can read these books. And
that's it. Yeah. And I mean, I've seen some seriously pale and hairy people in Melbourne. But I don't think they were vampires or werewolves. You are listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. And we have a few messages for you, but we will be right back after those.
You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. That was Freak by Silverchair, which was your choice by Kaz.
It was one of my choices.
Yes.
Silverchair have done a few weird, odd kind of songs, and that album was pretty well known for them.
Yeah.
But the Freak had a great video clip. Albert and I were just talking about it in the break.
Yeah, and it was where there was a plastic surgery patient and they were collecting her sweat. I just thought that's a nice setting for a movie we're going to be talking about soon. We've actually got some emails and SMSs come through. One's from an anonymous outback psycho killer, whoever you are, and says, "You guys are uber opinionated forest clearings, but we love you for it."
Thank you very much.
Yes, it would be anonymous other than we can actually see your email address. So thanks, Tony. We got an SMS from an anonymous person saying, "Are you kidding? I've seen Wolf Creek and it's nothing more than a road movie. I never understood the acclaim it has received." You're entitled to your opinion, and there are certainly a lot of critics out there that it probably could be seen as not very original, but, you know, it's...
Oh, absolutely. And like I said, I think it's the John Jarrett's performance that makes it particularly memorable.
Yeah.
Other than that, it would just be another, like...
Slasher movie.
Eli Roth style.
Yeah.
I mean, even though it was slightly before his work.
Yeah.
John Jarrett kind of makes it pop.
Yeah. Yeah. And we got a message from Marcus where he mentions an urban legend where he was always freaked out by Bloody Mary, where you're standing in front of the mirror and you say Bloody Mary three times. He says, "Great show, never listened before and I love it." Thanks, Marcus.
And I have a really interesting story. Well, it's not really interesting, that's a lie. when I was at primary school and the whole Bloody Mary thing. Now, there was a movie that came out around the whole Bloody Mary thing, Candyman.
Yeah, yes.
And we, you know, being stupid kids that we were, would stand in front of the mirror and try to call up Bloody Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And my God, when the principal found out about it, we were called to assembly and we were told to never do that again because, as my principal put it, you don't want to play with dark forces that you don't understand.
Yes, no.
So he called us off not to, you know, to stop congregating in the bathroom and doing stupid things and wasting time and we should have been studying. He told us off because we might have been playing with dark spiritual forces.
He believes all that, yes.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course you can summon Bloody Mary. Give it a shot, I think, if you're at home now.
Yeah, it's a nice time in the night to do that.
And if you survive it, let us know how you go.
Yes, yes.
You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam with Albert and Kaz tonight, and we've got a little bit of sci-fi, horror, movie and TV news for you.
Yes. In casting and movie news, the highly anticipated action-adventure Iron Man 2, directed by Jon Favreau and starring Robert Downey Jr., will be released into digital IMAX theatres simultaneously with the film's worldwide release in May 7, 2010.
And Halcyon, the film studio that filed for bankruptcy in August 2009, has found a bidder for their biggest asset, Terminator. Deadline Hollywood revealed today that Halcyon has selected Lionsgate as the stalking horse bidder for the franchise's rights. There's no word on what Lionsgate came in bidding at, but one would assume it is in the ballpark figure of the $25 million that Halcyon paid just 2 years ago.
Sherlock Holmes actor Mark Strong is in talks to play Sinestro in the Green Lantern movie, according to director Martin Campbell. "He's not only a wonderful actor, but he looks like Sinestro," he said to MTV News during the junket for Edge of Darkness, his upcoming action thriller opening January 29. "If you look up old pictures of Sinestro, he's very like him." Campbell also clarified that there were no such plans of having Superman make a cameo in the Green Lantern. He even went on to say that no other DC characters would be seen in the film. This automatically puts an end to all speculation that was doing the rounds for the past year.
Twilight star Kellan Lutz has confirmed that he's a lead contender to star in the new Conan the Barbarian. "It's something that I've been actively going after because I'd die to put the weight back on," he told E! Online at the Division E! Party in LA. "I'm tired of playing young. I want to be the big guy that I was."
Creator-director George Miller has recently started the new Mad Max follow-up to star Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy. In a press conference over the weekend in Santa Monica, Mel Gibson has said he's leaving the door open to adding a cameo to the Mad Max series. While Gibson doesn't exactly say he'll come back, he doesn't say he won't. Variety reports that Mad Max 4 is slated to begin shooting in Australia in August.
The surprise hit Paranormal Activity will spawn a not-so-surprising sequel, and it's been given a release date at the end of October this year. The Hollywood Reporter's Heat Vision blog reported that Paramount has hired screenwriter Michael R. Perry and director Kevin Grotert, who was an editor on the Saw movies and director of The Sixth One, to create the sequel to Paranormal Activity. The pre-Halloween release date sets it against that date's reigning champion in previous years, Lionsgate's Saw series.
And as expected, Avatar took out two of the big awards at this year's Golden Globes. The epic won Best Motion Picture Drama and Best Director went to James Cameron.
We've decided that's going to be the last of our Avatar news
for
a while. Yeah,
it's kind of been stretched over quite a few weeks. I enjoyed the movie, I loved it, but yeah, there's just so much acclaim.
Time to give it a break.
Yeah.
Don't want James Cameron getting a big head.
Yes, yes.
Cardiff Bay will be the site for the Drama Village being planned by BBC Wales, and this has been announced after getting a go-ahead from the Welsh Government. All BBC dramas that would be produced in Wales would be shot here. All the future episodes of series like Doctor Who, Sarah Jane Adventures and Torchwood would be shot in the new location.
In related news, Fox is said to be developing an American version of Torchwood. Original creator Russell T. Davies is now living in the US and is set to write the script. There is even a possibility that John Barrowman will reprise his role as Captain Jack Harkness.
Again, another American remake, just like they remade Life on Mars.
Oh, yes.
And I'm just going to get angrier about it.
No original ideas coming out of
it's
there.
Terrible. Helen McCrory's website has confirmed that the actress of Harry Potter fame has landed a role in Doctor Who. McCrory played the role of Narcissa Malfoy in Harry Potter, and now she's all set to act in the Matt Smith series of Doctor Who.
After the ultimate cancellation of Fox's Dollhouse, creator Joss Whedon can focus entirely on a sequel to Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, but he'd better do it quick. Star Neil Patrick Harris only has a limited amount of time to put on his white lab coat again. Harris's sitcom leaves him only a few months between seasons to shoot other projects. We have from April till August off, which isn't a huge window, Harris said.
Variety is reporting that a pilot of Walking Dead has been greenlit. The show would be based on the popular zombie comic of the same name. The comic tells the story of a group of people trying to survive in a world stricken by the inevitable zombie apocalypse. And that's some sci-fi and Scream news for you this week. And we are celebrating Australia Day just a little bit earlier this year.
Yes, we are.
So we've been talking about Australian films.
Yep.
Including things like Wolf Creek.
Yes.
And we've been playing a little bit of Australian music as well that kind of has a bit of a spooky theme to it.
Yes, yes.
Look, Australia is an ideal setting for a horror film, I think.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you're looking at things like Wolf Creek, and there are a few reasons. I'm going to outline a few of them for you this show and over the next couple of hours. Look, my first reason that Australia is a great horror setting, we've got our nation's cannibal forebears. Now, for over 80 years, more than 165,000 convicts were transported to Australia. Among the mix of common thieves and prostitutes were the slightly nasty elements like murderers, rapists, and thugs. It's the very nasty elements.
Cream of the crop.
Absolutely. Thank you, England. Of course, Australia's immigration numbers fairly dwarfed those of the prisoners, but we've never quite been able to shake off the stigma of a nation founded by criminals.
Yes.
Unavoidable were hangings and executions, convicts escaping their bounds, and Australian-born folks turning bushranger, and all lending to the danger of an Australia already perceived as quite harsh and somewhat unforgiving. Incidents of cannibalism were officially recorded in at least New South Wales and Tasmania. Probably the most famous cannibal was the Irish convict Alexander Pearce, who's famous for twice escaping the colony of Macquarie Harbour in Tasmania and twice turning to cannibalism to survive. I think by the second time he was just getting greedy.
Oh, yeah, he had quite a taste.
He really did.
Yes.
The Last Confession of Alexander Pearce, which was released in 2008, and Van Diemen's Land, which was released in 2009, were all retellings of this story. A short film has also been based on Pearce's story. It's called Dying Breed, and it's about the fictional descendants of the convict. Now, I haven't seen it, but it starred Lee Whannell and Nathan Phillips. Lee Whannell is obviously the writer and producer of the Saw films, or most of them, and he occasionally makes an appearance in them. And Nathan Phillips, as you mentioned, was in Wolf Creek.
Yes.
He's also in another classic film, Snakes on a Plane.
Oh, yes.
For which he must be very, very proud.
I'm sure.
Oh, you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream. We're having our Australia Day special, and we've got some Aussie music for you coming up right now.
Vampires, zombies, ghouls and creatures from outer space. No, it's not Federal Parliament. It's Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9 with your presenters Kaz and Albert. We've been talking a little bit about Australian culture and how it shapes the landscape of science fiction and horror. That last track that we played was by Savage Garden, specifically Darren
That's
Hayes.
That's right. Darren Hayes, the lead singer of that. And the track was called Carry On Dancing. And we played that because Darren Hayes actually said that he was inspired by Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles to write that track. And it does have a slightly gothic sort of feel to it.
A little bit spooky. So we've been covering movies like Wolf Creek and gone through a couple of Australian authors and how Australia is kind of steeped in tradition of cannibalism.
I wouldn't call it a tradition exactly, but it's definitely there.
Yes, yes. I'm sure there's a lot of traditionalists out there that will claim that tradition is a little bit more important than progression. So the next segment we're going to talk about is about a short film that created a great horror franchise. And the film franchise is Saw, and it was all based around an Australian short film that was shot in 2003. It was directed by James Wan and written by Lee Whannell, which Kaz pointed out is in another movie with Nathan Phillips, who also Lee Whannell also starred in this movie. It was originally used to pitch their script for the full-length feature film Saw, which was made in 2004 to various studios and actors. David, played by Whannell, is an orderly in a hospital, which he describes himself as a glorified janitor. He has no enemies. He has no idea why anyone would target him for such a disturbing, hateful act that's portrayed in the short film. At the start of the film, he's knocked unconscious, and then he wakes up in a room where, with a reverse bear trap attached to his face that will rip his mouth open when a timer goes off at the back of his head. This was all revealed to him via a video of a puppet named Billy, who tells him that the only key to unlock the device is in the stomach of his dead cellmate. But of course, the untrustworthy puppet misguides David, and the man that carried the key is actually alive but under paralysis. David panics and slices into the man's stomach anyway. So if you've seen any of the Saw movies, you know that each of the films are kind of made up of all these little vignettes of disturbing scenarios of how you'd react in very stressful situations. Mm. So like Wolf Creek, it really plays on your mind and puts you in a situation where you think something like this could actually happen to you, and you question, how far would you go? Would you put your life before that of strangers?
Yeah, it's just that real moral dilemma.
Yeah.
It's also reminded me a little bit of Seven.
Yeah. The second movie in the Saw franchise, Saw 2, was criticised as being kind of just a rip-off of Seven. So after the release of the full-length Saw, the film was met with overwhelming success in the box office, both domestically and internationally. This greenlighted the sequel Saw 2 and later the rest of the Saw franchise based on the yearly success of the previous installment. Since its inception, Saw has become the second highest grossing horror franchise of all time, behind only to Friday the 13th. James Wan and Lee Whannell have stayed on in some way as either directors, producers or writers in all installments of the Saw franchise. And if you're interested, if you ever want to see what started the whole Saw franchise off, you can find this short film on the internet where it's referred to as Saw 0.5. So people have seen Saw, they like the franchise, which I enjoyed. It was similar to Hostel, but never really knew where it all started. Certainly Australian roots.
Well, that's the first thing I remember about it, hearing that it was these two Australian guys. Lee Whannell, who I'd seen in something else,
yeah.
Couldn't really put my finger on it, but his face was very familiar. And obviously he and James Wan, who I think met at RMIT, made this film together. And I, to be honest with you, I've only seen the first Saw film.
Yep.
And I still have the marks in my shoulder where my friend clung on to me.
Oh, yeah.
She was so frightened. Mm. And to be honest, I thought it was hilarious. It had Kerry Ells in it from Princess Bride.
And Danny Glover was the...
Yes, that's right.
The police officer.
Yep. I think it was pretty well done. But by... What are they up to? What's the next one they're releasing?
They're
sorry,
up to six.
To six.
Yeah.
It's a little bit much for me.
It's going on for quite a while. I think I've watched up to Saw 3 and they were able to create new ideas for the show. The villain went past this faceless puppet and it was Tobin Bell they used as the actual villain. But each of the Saw films, it's a revitalization of the villain because Tobin Bell, certainly his character's quite sick in the early episodes. I certainly haven't seen the latest movies, but the first two or three was something that certainly scared me a whole lot more than the zombie or vampire movies that
are out.
Well,
that's it. And like you said, it was because it's something that you could almost imagine yourself being in.
Yes.
And you'd think about what you would do in that same situation.
Yeah.
And it's done really well for them. I mean, Lee Whannell and James Wan have been able to move on to other projects.
Yeah. It probably says a little bit about what Australian talent keep in their back of their minds.
And that's it, sick, twisted Australian minds.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.